This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Imagine you're a decision maker with nearly no time at all to get your head round a big subject. So I invite you into a virtual chamber where the top experts take you through what you need to know in fewer minutes than it takes to do a yoga class. Before we get into this week's episode, though, I'd like to ask a small favour, which is to take a minute to give us a review wherever you get your podcast. It's going to help turn the podcast world's secret algorithmic formula in our favour and help other listeners find us. Thanks to S. Pemberton 2000, Greek Ship and LB65 for your recent 5-star reviews. Always very much appreciated. This week, what's going to happen in Belarus? That's the sound from Belarus, the landlocked country that sits between Russia and Europe. The re-election last week of the man called Europe's last dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, has proved one rigged ballot too many. The protests have been met by extreme police violence, but haven't abated. A new, fair poll has been demanded and rejected.
Пока вы меня не убьете, других выборов не будет.
That was President Lukashenko telling protesters that they would have to kill him before there was another election. Well, is that the only option for Belarus? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, who is Alexander Lukashenko? Joining me is David Marples, Professor of History at the University of Alberta in Canada and an authority on Lukashenko's regime in Belarus.
Well, he was a manager of a state farm. And in 1990, he was elected to the parliament, which was then known as the Supreme Soviet. And in that parliament, he became an interim head of an anti-corruption committee. And he was virtually unknown at that time. I mean, very few people knew him. And yet he went about this task on the anti-corruption committee with great gusto. So that's how he first made his name. And in 1994, Lukashenko decided to run in the first presidential elections in the summer of that year. And Lukashenko won the first round and went into a runoff round and then got an overwhelming 80% of the vote. And so he came to power in a quite legal fashion, even though he was a virtual unknown. And it was only after that that things started to go differently.
Okay, so he got 80% of the vote in a fair election in 1994.
In the second round, in a runoff round. Yeah,
So he must have had quite an appeal back then. What was it?
Well, I think the appeal was that he wasn't part of the corrupt hierarchy of the Communist Party. He was a member of the Communist Party, but he also put forward a platform of closer integration with Russia and to form some kind of military security union with Russia. He had a kind of populist appeal, I would say, a sort of early populist. He was a man who could talk to the population at any meeting or assembly or something like that. He was an effective speaker, but he wasn't a speaker who was a sort of traditional Communist Party speaker, the one who would use sort of communist rhetoric. He just talked like an average guy. He was presenting himself as a sort of man of the people who were prepared to stand on their behalf, represent their interests if they voted for him.
Politically, how could you define him at that point? Was he very pro-capitalist? Was he harking back to the old Soviet system? Was he for a mixture? Did he have an ideology?
At that time, he was appealing to Soviet-era nostalgia, that, you know, they'd once lived in a great country, that country had fallen apart. He claimed for a long time to have been the only deputy in the parliament to have voted against the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, records now show that he was absent when that vote was taken, but he claimed that for years. And this was also linked to, in his rhetoric, to the Second World War, to the fact that Belarus was part of the Soviet military that won the victory over the Nazis in the Second World War. That particular idea didn't manifest itself fully in Belarus, I think, until the early 21st century, when he began to fall out with Russia and look for some kind of national identification symbols. But it seems to have always been part of him, that he kind of grew up with this idea of living in a great state, and now he was president of a very small one, but still wanted to have the association with Russia.
Now, when did it become apparent that he wasn't a two terms and I'm off kind of president?
Well, I would say after about 2 years. I mean, in 1996, there was a constitutional crisis when both the parliament and Lukashenko were working on changes to the 1994 constitution. But Lukashenko's proposed changes were to enhance the powers of the president and reduce those of the parliament and also that of the constitutional court, two mechanisms that could be carefully controlled by the president. He established his term in office as dating from 1996 rather than 1994, so that he could stay another 5 years in power without holding an election. So I would say from the end of that period, from the end of 1996, you had in fact a presidential dictatorship in place.
Dictators can be a bit whimsical. Has Lukashenko established a reputation for doing some whimsical things with his dictatorship?
Well, I think Lukashenko's looked at different patterns at different times. I mean, his policy has been a very clever one, and that because of the geostrategic position of Belarus between Europe and Russia, he's managed to play off both sides quite skillfully at different times in his presidency, giving the Europeans the idea that he's really open to some kind of reforms, when in fact he's never made the slightest move in that direction, and allowing Russia to think that he's a partner in most of Russia's integrative schemes. So that's, I think, is his biggest skill, his political acumen, if you like. In terms of whimsical, I mean, he built hockey rinks in every major town of Belarus so he could go there and play hockey. You know, I watched him play hockey, and I know a bit about hockey. He's not a great hockey player, but the situation is always set up so that Lukashenko can either miss or score an open goal, and no one dare check him, you know, which is simply unheard of at hockey. He goes down the wing wearing a number one shirt, and no one dare go near him because of the repercussions that might follow. I heard a story, by the way, from a friend of mine who worked on Minsk City Council, where Lukashenko went rollerblading one day in the late 1990s, and he was there. And he thought it was like an exhibition, and he threw a tomato at him, which he missed. But the friend of mine was later beaten up that same night outside his apartment building, and his face was unrecognizable. So you oppose Lukashenko at your peril, especially in an open way.
And when did he really start to lose his appeal?
I would say he started to lose his popular appeal in the early part of 2017. It was in that year that he introduced a bill to give penalties to people who were unemployed for more than 6 months of the year. It was called unofficially the parasite law. And when that law was introduced, people began to gather in the streets en masse in protest. And that's the first time I've seen protests. And yet, in the past, the opposition had never really managed a united campaign that could have targeted, I think, all the areas of opposition. And I think this election now is that August the 9th was the first time we've really seen that happen.
David Marples, who'll be joining us again later. This last election in Belarus was President Lukashenko's sixth successive election victory. This time, he supposedly got 80% of the vote, and yet again, no one believed it. So how has he got away with it? Dr. Brian Klass is a political scientist from University College London and author of the book How to Rig an Election. Brian, is there any chance that President Lukashenko won this election fair and square?
No, there's absolutely zero chance that that happened. And we know that both from evidence from this year's election and from past elections. So in the pre-election stage, in which being an opposition candidate often earns you a one-way ticket to a jail cell or at least the back of a minivan that's unmarked to be roughed up, there's manipulation during the actual voting itself, where there's intimidation used. And then, of course, there's manipulation during the counting procedures, in which it is widely presumed, with good evidence to suggest this, that the numbers are effectively made up.
Why does he make it so obvious? I mean, why does he say 80%? Because nobody gets 80% anywhere in a free election. Why doesn't he say, I don't know, 57% or 63%?
So there's sort of two reasons for this. One is that you want to make clear to the opposition that they have been crushed. And the second reason is to try to create the veneer of legitimacy internationally that he's actually popular. Now, of course, we abroad know that this is not true, but Lukashenko has an ego he's trying to protect, and so he picks this number. Now, I will say that when I did fieldwork in Belarus, a former regime official told me that Lukashenko effectively picked the margin of victory that he wanted. And he actually had a difficult situation in 2006, in which he had said that he wanted 78% of the vote, again, to project this air of invincibility. And the problem was that the subordinates were worried about the consequences if they didn't deliver 78%. So they over-rigged the election and said, let's give him 81%. But then they told their subordinates, let's give them 83%, and so on, until he got too high of a number, and he publicly admitted rigging the election downward to make it look more legitimate. So there is actually thought that goes into this margin of victory, and unlike actual elections, the dictator has effectively picked the number for his own ego.
How can we then measure what the level of support actually is for Lukashenko in Belarus?
So the short answer is we can't, and that's because polling is normally the way that we would get at this, either through pre-election polls or by exit polling to ask people how they voted when they leave precincts. And both of those are not possible to do in Belarus. In fact, even when you have outside groups try to do election polling in a country like Belarus, the people on the other end of the phone answering the questions have reason to believe, quite credibly, that the person calling them is actually from the regime itself, trying to get them to admit their disloyalty. Nobody would answer honestly. So unfortunately, I can't give you a number of how much votes he actually received, but I can say with certainty that he did not receive 80% of the vote. And part of that also comes from the fact that when you see these videos of organic protests at factories, and the foreman of the factory says, stand up if you voted for Lukashenko, and nobody stands up, you know, these are places that are historically more likely to be supportive of the regime in the past, and still the bastions of support just are not there. So it was quite clear this was a farce from the beginning, and we never will know exactly how many votes he received in reality.
Brian Klass. But things have obviously gone wrong for the president now. Why? Olga Drindova is a Belarusian analyst based in the Research Centre for East European Studies at the University of Bremen in Germany. Olga, why do you think President Lukashenko has lost his grip on power during this election?
there were some very important triggers that contributed to this very broad politicization of Belarusians. And I would name three factors for that before the elections. The first one is definitely pandemic. And I think you already heard the way the president was talking about the coronavirus, that it's not that dangerous, it's a psychosis. And, you know, only those people who have some chronic diseases or who are overweight or who are just too old would die from it. So Belarusians really did not understand that. They really got angry and they didn't have any time to calm down because the electoral campaign started actually during the pandemic. And the second factor I would name is definitely the economic situation. Belarusians have never been rich, but according to the polls that were made in spring, over 60% of people said that the economic situation was bad. And it was the highest figure in the last 20 years. So now you can imagine what a person would feel if he is not feeling safe in terms of health and life, and also at the same time in terms of his economic condition. And then we come to the third factor, which is definitely new faces in politics. And I think Belarusians just, you know, maybe for the first time in many years, really got this hope that this time it could be different because there are other faces and because just everybody in society was too much angry about the president and about the government.
When Lukashenko was talking about the coronavirus, he said some very strange things and did some very strange things. Can you tell us what they were?
Yes, I mean, he was kind of half joking about, you know, staying at nature and taking a tractor and drinking some vodka. Second example is he was playing hockey and then a journalist came to him and he just said, okay, do you see any viruses here? No, I also do not see them. And that means they do not exist. I mean, it's just not funny for people who see that their relatives are dying. So the trust to authorities and to president personally really dropped during the pandemic. Belarusians did not have this feeling that their health and that their lives are, you know, being taken care of by the state. And they started at the same time to self-organize and to show solidarity to each other. So there were huge voluntary campaigns of Belarusians. They cooperated with business and even with Belarusian diaspora abroad. They bought all the medical items that the hospitals needed. And so they learned quite fast to be self-organized and to show solidarity. And I think this very high wave of solidarity and also politicization of people, they were politicized because they did not understand the reaction of the state. They were not feeling secure about their lives.
These things coincided. And then you feel that there were a series of mistakes made by Lukashenko during the campaign. What do you think they were?
So one of the most important mistakes by the authorities that they really did not realize how important those new social media are, how important actually internet is for politicizing people. So actually they realized it quite late. They even started, you know, to arrest the administrators of Telegram channels, but it was already too late because people were already in these networks and there is not really much the state can do, you know, with its traditional ideological system working mostly via televisions. The second mistake was to register Tikhanovskaya. Of course, in the eyes of the Belarusian president, this former housewife is just nothing. I think it was a kind of a joke for him even that he registered her. Actually, he was expressing his views on women because he said that the Belarusian constitution was not written for women. I think it was also one of his mistakes because actually he humiliated just half or even more than half of the population of Belarus. The society got once again really angry when they heard that. And I think it was also one of the reasons why Tikhanovskaya was supported by people because they wanted to show solidarity and support and, you know, just to show the president that women can also do some politics in Belarus. And of course, one of his most important mistakes till now is the level of violence that he let happen, so to say, after elections. This blood was just the red line that Belarusians would never forgive him.
Olga Drindova. So that's the background to the events of the last few weeks. Now I want to have an idea of what's going to happen next and what Belarus's famously neurotic neighbour Russia will be making of it. Still with me in the briefing room is Professor David Marples from the University of Alberta, and joining us is Elena Korostolova, Professor of European Politics at the University of Kent. Elena, you're Belarusian yourself. Has the scale of all this protest, has it surprised you?
Indeed. I think the level of mobilization and the scale of protest are absolutely astounding. And this is not just in Minsk. It is happening just everywhere. People of all ages and all walks of life are now also being involved in the protests. And that what I think shows massive mobilization. What is also quite symbolic is that all the kind of the bigger factories, most of them subscribed to strike. So we have Minsk tractor plant or factory, which actually contributes 7% to the country's economy. So all these industries very much continue their strike despite the threats of being fired from their workplace.
Now, the second thing I want to get an idea of, are these protests in any way anti-Russian and pro-European? How would you characterize them in that way?
I would call them politically neutral. They are neither anti-Russian nor pro-European. I think what they're calling for is for free and fair elections and for free and fair Belarus, and that's what matters. So it is very much Belarus-focused.
I suppose what I'm asking you both also is there anywhere a programme that the opposition forces have? Elena, can you discern such a thing?
They put forward a three-point programme. One of them is first to stop violence and persecution of innocent people. The second point is the release of all political prisoners. And the third point is the recognition of the 9th of August election as fraudulent and for a new election to be set up. So these are the three points that they put forward. And they made several attempts to contact the presidential administration, but unfortunately they got nowhere with that.
So, David, that seems to suggest that it's very interim. In other words, there isn't a kind of developed idea yet about where the country would go in the event of the reform movement winning an election.
No, there isn't. And I think the whole point of this campaign right now is to remove the president from the scene. I mean, that would be the ideal solution, because unless that happens, there's really no point in putting together any program. But the question is how to bring about his removal, and can it be done by inside forces? And that, I think, is the crucial question facing Belarus today, is how to bring that about peacefully.
I'm probably very naive about this, but it seems obvious that Vladimir Putin and Russia is the critical external force in all this. Can I just pose two broad alternatives for Putin's behaviour and see which you think is the more likely? One possibility is that he acts to crush the reform movement because he sees it as a threat, because it would possibly encourage a reform movement in Russia of a similar kind. Or to look at who emerges in the new leadership and embrace them, because actually they're bound to be very close to Russia because they have no alternative. Of those two broad possibilities, Elena, which do you think is most likely, crush or embrace?
I hope that the embrace would be a more likely scenario. We all know that, obviously, Lukashenko and Putin, they've never had an eye-to-eye proper rapport, and especially it's soured in the past few years. Although, of course, in the eyes of Putin, he's a kind of a known and predictable force. But at the same time, Putin is also well aware that Lukashenko has absolutely wasted and spent his political currency, his legitimacy in the eyes of the people. So in terms of keeping him in power, it could create possibly more difficulties than advantages. And I think it may be better to see who might emerge, because if you notice that the opposition forces, they've very carefully navigated the political campaign vis-a-vis Russia, in a sense that at no point there were references, any anti-Russian references made, which may give Putin an opportunity actually to see that maybe somebody else would be a much better way forward.
David, what do you think?
I'm more or less inclined to think along the same lines. I noted both Putin's spokesperson Peskov and also the foreign minister of Russia issued quite contradictory statements about the situation in Belarus. And that suggested to me that Russia is still debating how to respond. It's not really made any kind of firm decision. But I do not think that a sort of mass invasion force is going to come over the border anytime soon. simply because it's illogical. For one thing, Belarus has so many connections with Russia that it's not necessary to do that. Russia is supplying the energy to Belarus. They're building a nuclear power station in Belarus. And they've got two military bases in Belarus. So in a way, the population is also listening to Russian broadcasts and social media on a daily basis. So they are Russified to some extent. And therefore, it is not necessary. This is not Ukraine. You know, we've got a movement towards Europe, which is obviously going to move away from Moscow. The whole point is to move away from Moscow. That is not the case here. There's a feeling of weariness with Lukashenko, and that he's had his time and he's not going anywhere now. He's got nowhere to go. He's got no reforms to introduce. He's got nothing to offer the people, and they don't like him. So Putin, I think, is clever enough to realize that this is not the future of Belarus, and he might as well look around and see who's coming next, who's going to be the next one, and make sure that the next president of Belarus is a pro-Russian figure, someone who is going to identify causes along with Putin. That, I think, is a prime concern.
But how do you do that? I mean, do you do that by trying to help the candidate who you, if Lukashenko goes, who you identify as most pro-Russian? Or do you do that by seeing who gets elected and then making sure that they are pretty pro-Russian?
Well, Putin has made many mistakes on that regard in the past, you know, by identifying his candidate early and then alienating people by doing that and prompting them to vote for the opposite, which is exactly what happened in Ukraine in 2004.
Now, Elena, you're also an expert on European policy. What do you understand European strategy towards events in Belarus to be?
Well, there were several statements now issued, and one of them, of course, highlighted the prospect of sanctions. But at the same time, I think the EU is trying to kind of to hold on to the threat of sanctions until the last moment. And I think the key message that they can send to both Lukashenko, but also to the opposition, is that we need dialogue in terms of helping the country to move forward from this current stalemate. By the way, the Presidium of the Coordination Council.
And that's the reform movement.
Yeah, the reform movement. So basically, they don't really want to see any direct interference in Belarusian politics. Whatever support that might have been offered at this stage, they want to put it on hold. They want to try and do it themselves in order not to aggravate the relations with Russia. And I think that was the key message there.
Okay, that leaves one other principal actor, which is Lukashenko himself. David, what do you think he's going to do? Do you think he's going to get on a plane and go off to Tbilisi or somewhere and we'll forget about him?
No, I don't think there's any way he's going to step down. He's going to stay till the bitter end. And, you know, if he does go down, he's going to go down in flames, screaming and shouting. And he's seen a number of these takeover presidential changes in his lifetime. You know, the former president of Kyrgyzstan, I mean, he's been living in Minsk for a long time now. He's afraid of that happening to himself. I remember him talking about how Gaddafi was mistreated in Libya because he was beaten up and on the streets and tortured. And he is very afraid that might happen to him. And he's going to hang in there, build up his forces as far as possible, seal the borders, and stay there as long as he possibly can. And it's going to be very, very hard to remove him, frankly.
Why wouldn't Putin just find a way of bumping him off or organising a coup against him with Russian help? He must have all kinds of links in Belarus, and then sorting out that way.
Well, I think Putin is president of a country, is a national leader, and national leaders in general don't go around bumping off other national leaders because they fear the same thing might happen to them. I mean, more likely is it's going to be very strong persuasion, and Putin's not too bad at that either. But I think he's also got to reach some kind of accommodation with EU leaders, which I think is also quite plausible, that they agree together that Lukashenko has to go. I think it's a matter of months rather than years before we see an end to this regime. I think it's seen its time. And also economically, I think the strikes might prove to be a critical factor if Lukashenko was to step down. And if the strike movement was unified, and if it was able to endure and to resist all the attempts to stifle it by intimidating workers, if it can do that, then I think this could be a means to change the regime much more quickly than any kind of constitutional system that might be created or any, let's say, even more violent way to bring about a change of president, which we've already seen in other post-Soviet republics over the past 25 years or so.
David Marples there with Elena Korostolova, and my thanks also to Brian Klass and Olga Drindova. My conclusion to this is that the people of Belarus are in for a rough time. No one outside is going to save them, but nor will anyone necessarily thwart them. The future of their dictator is in their hands. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Richard Fenton-Smith, Kirsty Knight and Beth Sager-Fenton. The sound engineer was James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.